Good morning. May it please the court, Eric Pills for petitioners, and I reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Okay. Cape Wind proposes to build a massive wind turbine complex over a 25-square-mile area at a location and at a height that is literally in the way of current air traffic. It will force aircraft to alter their courses in order to avoid the turbines and will impair safety in the use of airspace in a number of other ways. The FAA does not dispute or deny that the project will have those effects, but it has deemed the project to be a non-hazard simply because a non-hazard despite those harms, simply because the turbines are less than 500 feet tall. The central issue in this case is whether the FAA's decision violates its duties under 49 U.S. Code 44718 to, quote, decide the extent of any adverse impact of a proposed structure in order to carry out its primary duty to, quote, preserve the navigable airspace for aviation.
Before we get to that, there's even the question of whether the FAA adhered to the criteria set forth in its handbook.
That's, yes, right. Your Honor.
So do you want to take us through your vision of that?
Well, the handbook establishes first what constitutes a substantial adverse impact. And the question there is, how many aircraft will the structure affect?
And it's a significance criterion.
That's correct. And so there's two things. One, will it cause an adverse effect, an interference? And that's simply defined initially by whether it will cause an aircraft to alter its course or altitude.
Well, the government position is that there's an anterior cutoff point, and that is that nothing counts unless it's, I forget, within 2 miles, I guess, at the airport, or over 500 feet. And it relies, certainly in the decision, entirely on 638C1 of the handbook. So your argument on that is what?
Our position is that that bright line per se rule is inconsistent and permissible under the statute.
You aren't accepting the proposition that that is the rule, because, I mean, 638C only says if it's an obstruction, then we go on to other things. It doesn't say the converse.
No, that's right, although there is circumstances in 6-3-8, I think it's B2, where the FAA does acknowledge that there are circumstances when an aircraft will be forced by weather to drop below 500 feet, below the obstruction threshold, and that that can cause the kind of substantial interference that give rise to a hazard determination. So they back off of the rule under certain circumstances, which apply here. But the more fundamental point is that Congress has directed the FAA in carrying out its duties under 44718 to decide any adverse effect. And the emphasis is on adverse effect. And if a project is causing aircraft to change course or altitude, is creating safety risks due to collision, due to potential interference during poor weather conditions, has the potential to cause delays in aircraft and interfering with the efficient use of the airspace, all of which the record shows here and which the FAA does not fundamentally disagree with, that is somehow not an adverse effect just because the structure is under 500 feet tall. The emphasis is on how does the structure adversely affect the use of the airspace.
So you're not challenging their position that in order to be a hazard considered one, it has to be 500 feet tall. Your argument is that 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 violates the statute. You're not arguing they're misreading their own regulation, I mean their own handbook?
I think that under the 8.8-3, I got my numbers confused.
En route operations, that's what we're in, right?
Right, the en route operations, under the subsection under that paragraph that discusses when the ceiling drops and they recognize the aircraft, I think there is room under their own regulations to find that this was a hazard.
They did not address that.
Right.
Issue.
That's correct.
Right.
It says, but would you just explain how you get there, since it says the structure would have an adverse effect on your navigation if its height is greater than 500 feet?
The first part, but under the subsection under unmanned operations, where it recognizes that aircraft do have to drop below 500 feet to avoid, to stay in clear weather, and that can bring an aircraft too close to a structure, that can give rise to a hazardous condition. And that's I want to make two points. So one is that under that provision, there's room for the FAA to apply its own regulation to find a hazard here. But the more fundamental question, which you posed, is that we do take the position that it is unreasonable and improper for FAA to set up that per se threshold rule that only something that meets the obstruction standard can be a hazard.
Assuming arguendo that it did set up such a rule.
Well, yes.
I thought that your argument was that they had ruled this out as an obstruction, and that, in fact, they could have found it to be one. But you seem to be saying instead that if they found it to be an obstruction, that would automatically mean a hazard determination.
It's confusing because the terminology is not necessarily matching up to common usage of the words. An obstruction has a particular meaning, and in this context, it simply means an object that's over 500 feet tall. It doesn't mean whether it actually blocks any traffic.
No, I understand that, but I'm trying to understand what your argument is in terms of what you think FAA should have done that it didn't do. Okay.
FAA should have looked at this project, taking in account the size of the project, the height of the turbines, the size, the area that it's covering, 25 square miles, considered what the traffic patterns are like in the area, where do aircraft actually fly, what are traffic patterns actually like.
But I guess, and you can help me understand this better, my understanding of how this works is that 44718 gives the FAA this opportunity to study possible adverse effects of construction that's in proximity to airports, right? So if they find that there's a problem, either an obstruction or it interferes in some way with the navigable airspace, then they do this study. So here they found that interference, they didn't find that it was an obstacle specifically, but they did find interference. They did this study that considered the statutory factors, and that apparently included a study on the impact of aircraft flying under these IFR or VFR rules. So I guess my question is, what difference will it make if they find that it is an obstruction? Doesn't that just get you a study?
Whether or not it's an obstruction should not make a difference when they do the study, because the study directs them to do a number of things, but three of them are applicable and important here. One, decide the extent of any adverse impact. Two, consider factors relevant to the safe and efficient use of the airspace, and to disclose completely the extent of the adverse impact on the safe and efficient use of the airspace. That's 44718.
There was a study here, so what is it that you didn't get because of their deciding this was not?
What they said was, there are impacts to the airspace, but they're not important. They don't warrant a finding of a hazard, and they don't create any adverse effect because the structures are not 500 feet, because the structures are not a obstacle. And the point is that Congress has directed the FAA to consider how will a structure affect the use of the navigable airspace and the safety of people, pilots and passengers. FAA did not do that. They simply said, this is not a problem, not because it won't have effects on the aircraft, but because the structure isn't 500 feet.
Suppose it did that and concluded, as you want, that it was a hazard. What's the consequence of that? Just set aside the Interior Department for a minute. Does that just mean that they can require lights to be put on it? I mean, they can't prevent it from being built, right? The FAA.
Not in and of themselves, no.
So look, what are the consequences of a hazard?
Well, I think it's...
They can't be mitigated.
They can't be mitigated.
Yeah, just explain it to me.
There's a number... I mean, first of all, there are... whether it's a permitting agency or local agency,
no,
that would take that in effect.
Forget that. Just
there's commercial impacts in terms of getting insurance and issues like that, but...
On who?
On the developer, on Cape Wind here.
No. So let's assume they find it's a hazard.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean in terms of the traveling public?
No. Just assume they find it. Why don't we just forget this Cape Wind, okay? Let's assume they find a very tall building as a hazard. So what is the FBI? I haven't switched cases yet. I guess all these agencies work together. The FAA, they can order a light to be put on top of it, right?
That's correct.
And I assume that navigational charts will indicate it's a hazard, correct?
Yes.
What else?
That's the extent of what has to happen,
right?
Strictly speaking, within the Part 77 process. Anything beyond that is a function of what other agencies...
It's a function of what other people do.
Correct.
Okay, great. All right. So that brings me to an antecedent question, which is your standing to bring this case. Do you agree with me that for you to have Article 3 standing, it has to be substantially likely that if you do win, that is, if in fact the FAA is wrong about its regulations and that it is ordered to do its study and it concludes it's a hazard, you have to show that it's substantially likely that that will cause the Interior Department to cancel the lease, right?
It may not be necessary to cancel the lease, but to prevent to do something to make sure that the project is not built in a hazardous or unsafe way, yes.
You'd like cancellation, yeah. But you go for mitigation measures, as your brief clearly says.
Something along those lines.
Let me just finish my question, okay? So given that the Interior Department went ahead and approved the lease, even though it knew the FAA wasn't finished, and given the fact that when the FAA approved the lease, it considered dozens of issues and the views of dozens of agencies, including the FAA, tell me what makes you think that it's likely, much less substantially likely, that a hazard determination by the FAA will cause the Interior Department to change its mind.
Well, I think it's two things.
Yeah, what?
Primarily, it starts with their statutory duty to ensure that the project provides for safety. And if the FAA comes forward with a finding that says this is a hazard and raises serious safety concerns, I think that triggers a statutory duty on the part of Interior to consider what they're going to do. And throughout this process, they've linked the substance of Interior's decision to the substance of FAA's decision by requiring the implementation of any mitigation measures,
right?
By withholding the issuance of the lease,
right,
until the FAA's decision was made. And furthermore, in the lease, there's a provision that provides for an ongoing requirement to follow any directives of the orders of the FAA with regard to safety going forward throughout the term of the lease. Mm-hmm. And the lease also specifically prohibits Cape Wind from carrying out the project in a way that would create a hazardous or unsafe condition. Right. So,
But you just explained to me when you said that the hazard condition, there's no allegation in here, that, at least that I've seen, that the hazard determination would be based on anything like, you know, it's totally unsafe for aircraft to fly anywhere in the area, right? I mean, your argument is that this is a, I mean, as you said, the most they can do is say it's a hazard and order light be put on it and stick it on navigation charts.
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry. If they say it's a hazard,
yeah,
then they've said it's a hazard. And then,
but that doesn't mean it's dangerous, right? I mean, it may mean that airplanes just have to fly around it.
No, I would disagree with that. Yeah. It does mean that it's hazardous because it is.
But it warns planes to fly
but
elsewhere, correct?
Yes, because, I mean, because it's unsafe.
But I'm looking back at the legal standard here, substantially likely. I just don't see, and you can make the case for me here, just give me your best argument for why you think it's substantially likely that the agency, having approached this the way it did, you know, and having considered dozens and dozens of different factors, including this, why you think a hazard determination by the FAA is substantially likely to make the Interior Department think that it's going to completely recalculate this long, complex process it's been through and stop the lease.
If the Department of Interior is willing to say, Cape Wind, you have to do anything that FAA tells you in order to mitigate the hazard, anything. It's a blank check for FAA to mitigate the hazard.
Yeah.
They turn around and say, this is a hazard that can't be mitigated.
Well, what would they say to me? Well, let me ask you about that first. The ROD says, if AA concludes that a hazard exists, it would then, if possible, develop mitigation measures to reduce or eliminate. So, you know, the Interior Department is contemplating the fact that it might not be reduced, whatever the hazard is.
And my point is that if they're willing to do anything, require implementation of any mitigation measures to avoid it being a hazard, and now FAA says it is a hazard.
So what's
what's
the mitigation that is likely in a case like this? Suppose, just take this case. Suppose you're right, and suppose that they look at it now and they say, yeah, it's a hazard. And what are the mitigation, considering the situation, so we're only talking about visual flight stuff, right? Because the radar is a different situation.
The radar is different. We're talking about visual, but also the instrument flight rules. But I think there's a, maybe we're not on the same page on one point.
Right.
If they say it's a hazard, it means that it can't be mitigated.
Okay.
They may say you have to do certain things to make the best of it,
offer?
But it's still a hazard.
Okay, fine. But what would they, I was only responding to your argument that, you know, Interior is ordered Cape Wind to implement any mitigation, and I was asking what mitigation would be possible.
And my point was that if the FAA says it's a hazard, it means it can't be mitigated. There are no mitigations that can be implemented to remove the hazard, to make it non-hazardous. And so in that case, my point is that having agreed that you could implement any mitigation that might be out there to avoid a hazard, if FAA says it is a hazard that can't be mitigated, it seems much more likely that Interior will take steps to prevent the hazard from being built.
Develop mitigation measures to reduce or eliminate. So reduce.
And my posit is that can't be done. That's why they would call it a hazard, because it can't be mitigated to reduce or eliminate the hazard.
To make sure, your reply brief, I think your blue brief also makes this pretty clear, but certainly your reply brief makes it clear that you're interested in mitigation measures, right? That is to say that one way of winning is to get mitigation measures, the exact scope of which none of us can possibly predict.
That is possible, yes.
Yeah. Okay, but that's true with the radar, right?
In other words, it's
true with the radar, right?
It's certainly true with, I wouldn't say certainly. I have to say, it isn't clear to me that there is any way to mitigate either of them. And I'm not going to represent that there is a way to do that. I don't know what that is, if it is. It is certainly possible that there could be mitigation, whether it's substantially reducing the size and height of the facility or other measures that, I don't really know, that could address the problem. But we'd have to see what that is.
So what is your claimed injury here? Is it if these turbines are built at all, or is it how they're built?
Well, it depends on what actually is built. As proposed now, this would be a hazard and would pose serious safety risks and dangers to the traveling public over the sound.
Wait, so what's the answer to Judge Brown's question? How does that injure you?
Well, in two ways. One, the alliance represents in its membership pilots and other travelers over the airspace. And as we've said in our brief, the airport is affected because of the impacts on on the use of the airspace can cause delays and reduce traffic at the airport that directly affects the town as owner of the Barnesville Municipal Airport.
Uh-huh. And therefore.
So that's the injury.
And how would so would they be satisfied with a interior with a FAA finding that that simply says it is a hazard and you have to keep the lights on top?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that would to call it a hazard as it is now. Yes, that's what we are ultimately asking for.
But suppose the Interior Department continues with the lease.
Well, then we would have issues with the Interior Department.
But see, that's my point. The point is, for you to seek that relief in this case, you have to show that the hazard determination will actually affect significantly what the Interior Department does.
And what I'm saying is, when you look at the history of how Interior linked its decision-making to FAA's decision-making under this process, that there's a direct substantive link. And it's if Department of Interior has made it clear that they're going to do what they can do to prevent an unsafe, a hazardous facility from being built. If FAA says it's hazardous, it can't be mitigated, I have to believe under its statutory duties that Interior will do what it needs to do to make sure that doesn't happen.
But with respect to the other agencies whose views the Interior Department considered, quite a few of them found problems, and the agency went ahead anyway. So, I mean, you know, like they found a problem with the impact of this on Indian tribes, and they said, yeah, it's a real cost, it's a problem, but it's outweighed by what's going on, and they found consequences for other things from the agencies, but they didn't defer to all the agencies. They considered their views and decided that the benefits outweighed the costs.
And I think the difference here is that from the statements in the environment and the supplemental environmental impact statements to the record of decision and into the very terms of the ongoing lease itself, the Department of Interior has consistently linked the substance of its decisions regarding the entire project on the substance of FAA's decision regarding a hazard determination. And if the FAA says it's a hazard that can't be mitigated, that certainly makes it substantially more likely that Interior will take steps to ensure that the hazard is not built.
Okay, do you have anything else?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Daniel Lenners for the Federal Aviation Administration. I believe the Court is somewhat confused by petitioner's arguments regarding when FAA will find a hazard and what that determination means.
That was going to be my first question to you. Excellent.
Are you talking about standing now or the merits?
Just factual, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Facts.
Your Honor,
What is it? Just would you go ahead? What happens when the FAA finds something to be a hazard?
When FAA finds a project to be a hazard, it issues a determination that the project consists of a hazard as proposed to be built that cannot be mitigated.
Okay.
So before finding that a particular project constitutes a hazard to air navigation, FAA will look into a number of ways to avoid that determination, one of which is negotiations with the project sponsor to eliminate the condition that causes a hazard. Another is adjustment to the affected aviation operations and procedures such that the structure would no longer be considered a hazard. An example of that is when planes land, they land in stages. At point A, they may go to 3,000 feet, at point B to 2,000 feet, at point C to 1,000 feet. If a structure is going to interfere with that pattern, FAA may change the operation to move the point at which the plane goes from 2,000 feet to 1,000 feet. And finally, as the handbook makes clear, not only must the proposed project have a substantial adverse effect, but, quote, the affected aeronautical operations and or procedures cannot be adjusted to accommodate.
Wait, before you go to the handbook, so let's assume that the FAA is, let's assume that the tower is, that you've got a tower and that you agree, it's the agency agrees it's a substantial interference, and the question is whether it can be mitigated, right? So let's assume that you've looked, the agency's looked at all the adjustments that can be made, and it's finally concluded that this particular, these particular turbines are hazards, that they can't be mitigated, okay? Now what happens? Oh, and I take it one thing that's done is you, they require light be put on it, right?
Your Honor, yeah. The FAA cannot even require that the structures be lighted. They
really?
Can recommend that they be lighted, uh-huh. But FAA's no hazard determinations have no legal effect whatsoever.
But we know in this case yeah. that any mitigation measure declared by the FAA will automatically, by the terms of the lease, be added to the duties of Cape Wind.
Yes, Your Honor. And so in this case,
any mitigation measure, right? I mean, that's the way it's phrased.
That's correct, Your Honor. But
and we have no idea at this stage in the litigation what the scope of such mitigation measures might be.
I disagree with that, Judge Williams. The FAA cannot, as a mitigation measure, require the turbines be built in a different place. They cannot require that they be shorter. They cannot require that they be further apart. That would be a change to the scope of the project that has been presented to
FAA.
What
about a requirement that Cape Wind provide, I guess it's transponders for the planes that are using this space? Any reason why it couldn't do that?
I believe that FAA could suggest that, although I don't...
It suggests it. We learn from the lease that Interior will adopt it, right?
Has anybody suggested that in this case?
No one suggested that in this case, Your Honor, and I'm unaware of any instance in which FAA has mandated such, I guess, an onerous requirement.
We haven't gotten to the question of FAA trying to make trade-offs between preserving the project and preserving airplane safety.
Your Honor, no such trade-off has been necessary here because...
Well, the FAA, you agree that the FAA did not reach that question.
No, Your Honor, I disagree. The FAA found that the project as proposed would not constitute a hazard to air navigation, both because of the turbine's location and their height. They're in the middle of the water. They're less than 500 feet in the area of en route operations, and because...
That's in reliance on the FAA's reading of 638C1.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the FAA also found in its no-hazard determination that the turbines, because they would be appropriately marked on charts and lighted, that pilots using visual flight rules would be able to see them and avoid them. So they found that they would not be hazardous to airplanes because planes could safely circumnavigate the project. That's in the no hazard determination, Your Honor.
Suppose we thought the agency was wrong about the 500 foot rule and sent it back for the agency to take a fresh look, setting that aside of whether it's a hazard. And suppose it decided it was a hazard. What's the consequence of that?
Your Honor, again...
For the FAA and the public.
The consequence for the public, I believe, is that FAA would mark the structure as a hazard on its maps were it then built.
Uh-huh. And people would just... And that would warn people about...
That would warn pilots.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can the FAA restrict airspace?
Yes, Your Honor, and they have not suggested that the airspace here needs to be restricted as a result of the turbines being built. FAA.
So over Washington, for example, you can't fly small planes. Is that an FAA decision? Is that a military? Who makes that decision?
I don't know who made the decision, Your Honor, that small planes.
But FAA does have the authority to restrict airspace.
It is my understanding that FAA possesses that authority, that the FAA handbook refers to restricting or excluding planes from airspace. FAA has not determined that to be necessary here.
The petitioners focus very emphatically on what they call this bright line standard of the 500 feet that the FAA relied on. If FAA didn't make that decision, in other words, if they didn't say it's not an obstruction because it's not more than 500 feet, what would have been different about the determination?
Your Honor, as we point As we pointed out in our brief, nothing would have been different. FAA appropriately considered the impact these turbines would have on air navigation, regardless of their height. The MITRE study shows that MITRE looked at all of the airplanes flying in this area over a four-month period. It looked at the direction in which those planes were traveling and the height at which they were traveling. FAA determined that the structures under 6.8C1, it determined that because they were not 500 feet or more, it did not constitute an adverse impact for the purposes of that provision. But FAA separately looked at the whether the turbines could be avoided by airplanes if they were appropriately marked on maps and lighted, and found that airplanes flying lower than 500 feet could safely avoid the turbines in bad weather conditions and otherwise. And so there's nothing different about FAA's study that it undertook here based on this 500-foot obstruction standard. The only difference is that FAA did not conclude that it had an adverse impact as a result of being of 6.8C1.
When I asked Mr. Piltz about the standing question, his answer was, look, interiors pay close attention to what the FAA is doing here. It's built into the lease. It's required all mitigation. Of course, if they find it to be a hazard, the Interior Department's going to reconsider its position. What's your answer to that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I believe that it's plaintiff's burden to show a substantial likelihood that Department of the Interior would not only reconsider its decision, but cause the turbines not to be built. And although Interior considered FAA's views, it also considered the views of numerous other individuals and agencies.
Did any of those people presenting views for consideration have behind them any equivalent of Section 1337P4 requiring that the Interior take account of safety, in fact, make sure that safety is achieved?
I'm not aware, Your Honor, of what the other commenters had at their disposal. I know that the Department of the Interior, for example, chose this particular project despite the fact that it would not have the least impact on the environment. They considered proposals in different areas. They considered proposals for smaller projects. They considered a proposal in which this project would be built in stages. And the Department of the Interior rejected all of those despite the fact that those might have less of an impact on the local environment. And they chose this project for numerous reasons, because of it would advance the administration's priority in renewable energy, because it would provide electricity to 80% of the residents in the area, because it would provide jobs. It's the nation's first offshore wind facility.
Some people feel that aviation safety might actually, as a categorical matter, require more attention than many of the things that go into environmental impact statements. Perhaps not all of the things that go into environmental impact statements, but certainly some of them.
Again, Your Honor, the Department of the Interior required Cape Wind to institute the mitigation measures required,
right,
or suggested by FAA to make the turbines consistent with air safety. FAA found that because the turbines would be appropriately marked and lighted, that pilots could avoid them, and therefore they were not inconsistent with air safety.
Did the FAA do anything with the MITRE study's finding about the 425 flights that go through the airspace that's affected? I didn't see that in the passages of the decision that you pointed to.
Your Honor, I don't believe that FAA ever directly addressed that. I believe it addressed it indirectly by its finding that pilots could safely circumnavigate or go over or around the turbines because they would be appropriately marked and lighted. That's an implicit recognition that there were, in fact, flights that were being affected. FAA recognized that. Petitioners want the court to find essentially that FAA was mandated to find this was a hazard because flights would be affected. But FAA recognized explicitly in its no hazard determination that flights would be affected, but it found that those effects were not were consistent with safety, that pilots, although affected, could safely go over and around the turbines. There's nothing in the statute that mandates FAA find a no hazard, find a hazard to exist here. The term hazard is nowhere used in the statute. The statute requires that if the turbines may have an adverse effect, the FAA conduct a study. And there's nothing in the FAA handbook that mandates FAA to find a hazard here.
Is there anything in the record that would suggest, and this question's related to visual flights, is there anything in the record that suggests that it's actually dangerous to fly visually in the area if the they're lighted and it's on, right? That's fine. Is there anything that suggests it's dangerous?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. To the contrary, FAA, I don't remember if it found it explicitly, but has determined that the turbines, because they were lighted, would give pilots a visual reference where none now exists. So pilots
well,
in the middle
there's no, well, but there's no tower now. There are no turbines now.
That's right, Your Honor. So a pilot...
you mean your point is... Wait, what?
My point is, Your Honor,
the point.
Right? Pilots flying under visual flight rules are relying on their eyes to fly.
Correct.
So they rely on things on the ground by which to navigate.
Oh,
for
so
example, riverbeds or coastlines.
So this would make flying safer.
This would give pilots a visual reference to use when flying in the area where none now exists.
I take it the key passage of the decision is the one sentence in the middle of page 7. The proposed structures would be appropriately marked and or lighted to make them conspicuous to airmen should circumnavigation be necessary. And that is the entirety of the FAA's reasoning on the question of the impact of the 425 flights that would have to move?
Yes, Your Honor, and that sentence comes exactly after the paragraph in which FAA says, it is recognized that some aircraft operating under visual flight rules may have to alter their altitude or route of flight. And then they say the structures would be appropriately marked and or lighted to make them conspicuous to airmen should circumnavigation be necessary. So FAA recognized that there were an effect on flights in this area, but it found that it was not a substantial adverse effect because pilots could safely circumnavigate the turbines.
Anything else?
Wouldn't it be appropriate to at least picture the way in which those flights would have to move as a result of actually FAA rules requiring the 500-foot separation, and then the impact of those flights moving on other flights which were located above or to the side of them under current conditions?
Your Honor, the FAA, there are many circumstances in which a flight moving due to a structure constitutes a hazard, where a flight cannot safely avoid a structure and therefore that structure constitutes a hazard. There are many areas in which that would be the case. Here, because of the location in the middle of the water and their height, less than 500 feet, FAA found that they could be safely avoided with no impact to air safety. As far as petitioners claimed effects on local displacing other aircraft, there's nothing in the handbook that would require FAA to find those effects constitute a hazard. So while they may have an effect, they're not an adverse effect or a substantial adverse effect such that FAA would be mandated to find a hazard. Again, I believe petitioners are confusing an effect on local air operations with a adverse effect on those operations and with a substantial adverse effect on those operations. And it is only when there is a substantial adverse effect that cannot be mitigated through negotiations with the project sponsor or adjustments to the affected procedures that FAA will conclude that a proposed structure will constitute a hazard to air navigation.
Thank you.
Despite the wording of your brief and the wording of the decision, you're not relying on your reading or the FAA's reading of 638C1.
Your Honor, 638C1 is one of many considerations that the FAA gave to these structures' impact on flights. Because 6381 was not triggered, because the turbines were not more than 500 feet tall, FAA ruled out that consideration. But it did take into account many other standards, both in the handbook and as brought up by petitioners, and found that these turbines were consistent with air safety in this area.
Is there any, one of the arguments that the petitioner makes about the radar is, in his brief, is that the, what is it, AR-11? Is that the substitute radar? Do I have the right name?
Yes, Your Honor.
ASR, is that what it is?
I believe it's ASR-11.
ASR-11. They say in their brief it may not be available. Is there any evidence in the record about that you know of?
There's no evidence one way or the other, Your Honor. Uh-huh. FAA has independently verified that an ASR-11 is available, not in the record.
I see. You're just telling us that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But there's nothing in the record one way or the other?
Correct, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does Mr. Pils have any time left? Okay, you can take 2 minutes.
I want to address mostly the question of danger, because the record does contain ample evidence of real dangers as a result of the project. For example, in poor weather conditions, in the summertime, there's frequent periods over 20 days a month, the record shows, of cloudy and low visibility conditions. Traffic is concentrated. Two-thirds of the annual traffic occurs in the summer months. And the affidavits from both the airport manager and Mr. Scott LaForge, who's president of one of the local airlines, testify that the frequent occurrence is fog banks quickly rolling in and descending and shutting down visibility very quickly, forcing pilots in visual conditions and sometimes IFR to drop below the cloud cover to stay clear of the fog. The problem with putting in a 440-foot turbines over 25 square miles is apparent. As you drop down, where do you go? And where can you go to avoid these turbines? FAA now says, oh, it's a benefit to navigation because there'll be lights on and it'll help them navigate. That assumes that they'll, A, see the lights through the fog and see them in time to avoid the turbines. And it's just that kind of specific local condition that was never analyzed. Mr. Leonard says that the FAA looked at beyond the 500-foot rule, but read the rest of that sentence on page 7 of the decision, which is also page 7 of the joint appendix. While it is recognized that some aircraft operating under visual flight rules may have to alter their altitude or route of flight under the order 7400-2G, paragraph 6-3-8C1, states that a structure would have to have an adverse effect on VFR en route air navigation if its height is greater than 500 feet above the surface at its site and within 2 statute miles of any regularly used VFR route. The Cape Wind project is within 2 statute miles of a regularly used VFR route. However, the requested height for those structures is not greater than 500 feet above the surface at their site. Therefore, according to the order, the wind turbines at their proposed location height do not meet the criteria to have an adverse effect. It was ruled out to have not a non-adverse effect only because of its height, even recognizing that it would do the exact same things to air navigation that would warrant a hazard finding if it were over 500 feet. That's the fundamental.
Your argument is that the next sentence, apart from being completely conclusory, seems like just a throwaway after the apparently complete reliance on 638C1.
It is a complete throwaway, and more so because they never draw. They don't do the fundamental thing they're supposed to do, which is show how they got to that conclusory statement. There's no connection to substantial evidence in the record to show that's possible. Under the local conditions, are you really going to be able to see it? The lights? Are you really going to be able to see them in time to do anything about it, given the low altitude of traffic, given the low cloud cover, and the other local conditions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. We'll call the next case, please.